С праздником, друзья! Слава России!
Most of them will never attend the Russian march. Most of them won't ransack a vegetable warehouse searching for migrants. And most are unlikely to attack a train from Tajikistan. But they are deeply disturbed by what they perceive as an influx of migrants and with the criminality they associate with this. Many believe, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary, that non-Russian citizens of the Russian Federation are privileged and that ethnic Russians are discriminated against. To get a grip on Russian nationalism today, we need to look beyond its dramatic and violent manifestations, like the recent race riots in southern Moscow or the attack on a Moscow-Dushanbe train, and look at its more latent and widespread variant. And widespread it is. According to a recent poll by the independent Levada Center, as many as 80% of Russians harbor xenophobic sentiments. And it is this latent nationalism of the silent majority that is driving much of the political dynamic right now. It's prevalent among the young, the affluent, the educated, and yes, the otherwise liberal. And its adherents are very much in play politically. Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there, Brian.
And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean. Good to see you again.
Good to be back. Thanks.
And joining us from Middletown, Connecticut, that's my home state, is Kevin Rothrock, project editor for Runet Echo at Global Voices, author of the blog A Good Treaty, and an indispensable observer of the Russian blogosphere. Welcome back, Kevin.
Very, very happy to be here.
Very happy to have you. Nearly 73% of Russians and more than 80% of Muscovites favor the deportation of migrant workers. Some 66% of Russians agree to some degree with the idea that Russia is for Russians, while only 19% said such sentiment was, quote, fascist. Only 6.8% of Russians feel respect and compassion for people from the Caucasus, and more than 30% of Russians and 48.9% of Muscovites feel antipathy toward them. These are just a few of the alarming numbers that came from a recent Levada Center poll. Mark, what do you make of these numbers?
Well, first point is I think we always have to be dubious about the specifics of any one particular poll. You know, a lot of it depends on quite how it's framed and so forth. I mean, 19% say fascist, but you know, there's a wealth of difference between just fascist and just I don't particularly like it. But I think I'd want to question in some ways how new this is. If I think back to, God, the days when there was still a Soviet Union, and I did my doctorate on the impact of the Afghan War on the Soviet Union, one of the absolute constants that I would find whenever I went around is that whichever Soviet nationality I was talking to, they would invariably say, it's our boys who are suffering disproportionately. You talk to Balts and they would say the Russians are sending us to die because this is their way of basically depopulating the Baltic states. You talk to Azeris, you talk to Kazakhs, and you talk to ethnic Russians, whatever. They would all say that. Then when you look at the casualty data, it became clear that actually, beyond a sort of few little sort of blips and things, but broadly speaking, this was a multi-ethnic war effort that was reflecting of the whole Soviet population. So there's nothing new about people thinking that their particular ethnicity doesn't have a fair shake. And I think, therefore, a lot of these figures are probably not that different from ones that we'd have seen 10 years ago, 20 years ago. What I do think is different is the context. First of all, you know, it seems fairly indisputable that economic bad times are coming. And bad times generally are ones in which people are looking for scapegoats. And also it creates the irony that on the one hand, cheap migrant, whether foreign or domestic, gastarbeiter labor is all the more useful. But on the other hand, probably all the more resented. And the second contextual change is precisely that the extent to which this is being used and mobilized politically. the Kremlin has always had this challenge that it would like to tap into ethnic Russian nationalism, but on the other hand, it needs to be able to deal with non-Russian elites. It needs to hold together a multinational federation, and therefore it's had to kind of create this rather clumsy Russian state nationalism. But on the other hand, of course, we now have a whole variety of other actors, of whom Navalny is only one, who aren't trapped by the same sort of practical challenges. And therefore, there is more scope now for ethnic Russian nationalism to be mobilized by serious political actors who want to do something with it in a way that, if you looked at Zhirinovsky, I mean, all he really wanted to do by mobilizing nationalism was just to ensure himself a place at the feeding trough.
Right. No, you make a good point that this in a lot of ways is nothing new. And anybody that was in the Soviet Union heard similar things to what you heard, or even in the 90s in the Russian Federation, I would come across xenophobic at best, racist at worst sentiments on practically a daily basis. But when you look at this poll, now Levada has been doing this thing since 2002, and I'm actually got it in front of me right now. And if you look at the trend lines, there's a clear increase from 2007, 2008 up till now. So there's a noticeable and significant increase on each one of these matrices. And there are many. It's a very, very comprehensive poll. And I'd suggest anybody, any of our listeners, take a good look at it, because it is very eye opening. But Mark, you do raise a real interesting point here. And I want to go to Sean on this, because Sean, historically speaking, and you're one of our in-house historians, how do these numbers, and I know you don't have numbers from history to compare it to, but how does this look to you? Has Russia always been this nationalistic and this xenophobic? Are we just noticing it more now? Is what used to be latent now becoming more manifest? Can you think of parallels from the past that might shine some light on this?
Well, I think that, as Mark said, there's all, I don't want to say always, but the idea that there's tension between people of various ethnic backgrounds in Russia has a long history, of course. And sometimes it's historically, this has erupted in mass violence. I mean, one can only need to reference pogroms against Jews in the latter part of the turn of the 20th century. But ethnic tensions have existed for, throughout Russia's history, I would say. And you get from the archival evidence, we have certain episodes of this, particularly in cases like we have now, where you have a lot of immigration. In the 1930s, during a mass urbanization under Stalin's first five-year plan, you have ethnic tensions, of course, between workers who are migrating to Moscow. And I think that as Mark said, the context here is – so I can't say if has Russia been nationalistic. I think we should be careful with using this term nationalism, mm-hmm. and kind of define exactly what it means, because ethnic strife and one person, a Russian not liking Tatars and Tatars not liking Russian, doesn't necessarily mean nationalism. What I perceive now is – which does speak to a nationalism, is the idea of a Russian nation that's separate or should have certain privileges, and Russians should have certain privileges separate from other ethnic groups. Mm-hmm. And then, another thing that we could say that this seems like more nationalism is that there is an attempt to politically organize around these ideas. Mm. So I would be careful with using this term nationalism and differentiating it between kind of more general ethnic animosity and ethnic hatred. Mm-hmm. If it's a scattered kind of individualist, then it doesn't necessarily mean nationalism. But we see here from these poll numbers, and they have been increasing over time. That's definitely true. Yeah. You get more
from
07. Sentiment.
From 07.
Yeah, from 07, from these poll numbers, we do see more and more Russians kind of identifying themselves as separate from as non-Russians. And I think this is a very troubling thing, because as we all know, what is Russia except for a multi-ethnic state? I mean, Russia has never been for Russians, and nor, frankly, will it ever will be. And I think the political context is interesting for this, and also the international context. I mean, I think we should recognize that there kind of in many places in the world, because of immigration, because of globalization, you have a rise of right-wing sentiment, particularly anti-immigrant sentiment. You have it in the United States, you have it in Western Europe, you have it in Eastern Europe, of course, and of course you have it in Russia and other places around the world. And I would say that this is a general phenomenon of the, you know, the beginning of the 21st century, because you're having a different type of immigration, mostly labor immigration, coming from, in Europe's case, coming from Africa, or in Russia's case, coming from Central Asia. Mm-hmm. And this is feeding into a lot of tensions within Russian society amongst Russians who feel they're being inundated by others, right, ethnic others from the outside.
No, that's a very important point you make, and is something I wanted to bring up at some point, is how much is this is just part of a global phenomenon. Almost the old North-South divide is manifesting itself this way in the 21st century. Kevin, those Levada numbers point to what I would call, I guess, a high level of latent xenophobia. That's the way I could kind of characterize it. While recent events like the riots in southern Moscow point to the intensity of part of that xenophobia that has become manifest, do you see the former turning into the latter? Will this latent xenophobia become even more manifest, and we'll be seeing more of these kinds of incidents? Or how do you see this playing out? You monitor the blogosphere pretty closely, and you get your thumb on the mood pretty good usually. How do you see this playing out?
All day, every day. I'm glad you pointed out the proximity of this poll to the riot outside Moscow, because for what I gather, the poll was conducted simultaneously, possibly even asking the exact same people, which I would think
25th to 28th of October,
which could potentially bias some of the results. Yeah. Now, obviously, there is a long term trend, but
It fits. But what the results do, I was looking for that, and the jump was just year on year, pretty much similar to what it was every year on most of the big questions from 07. So I don't see an overwhelming jump.
Nothing overwhelming. I agree, but to some degree, the sort of what we might be seeing is a possible spike, at least in part, because of the riot that just occurred in Moscow. And even though this was a national poll, that other poll by Levada conducted at the same time showed that 77% of Russians nationally were aware of the riot in Biryova. Mm. So that's noteworthy, I think.
Right.
But aside from that, the other point that I wanted to make about the poll and the trend in Levada's results, second only to Caucasian migrants, and there it's not entirely clear if respondents had in mind foreign immigrants from the South Caucasus or immigrants from within the Russian Federation, or migrants, I should say. So that much is not entirely clear in the poll. Or it's not clear that Russians understood the exact same thing when responding along those lines. But second only to that group, Russians want to limit the inflow of Chinese.
Yes, that jumped out at me too.
Yeah, which is interesting. So I wonder to what extent this perception overlaps not so much with what we've come to know as Russian ethnic nationalism, but with strands of, say, Eurasian patriotism, or those who see Russia as a great power, in this case threatened by Chinese encroachment. Mm-hmm. What came to mind is Mikhailkov, the Kremlin-connected filmmaker. He just finished a new documentary on the Russian wilderness, and it propagates exactly this kind of xenophobia. So I wonder to what degree, when we look at those results, we should be interpreting it as evidence of say, ethnic nationalism, or the sort of Derzhavnost Eurasianism of people like Dugin and so on, who are a very different type of nationalist. And maybe calling them a nationalist isn't even right. Maybe you call them an uber patriot or something. But there is that kind of dichotomy in this debate. And I wonder if the results, how clear they are in terms of that.
Well, no, you raise a good point there too as well. I mean, I think they're probably mixed. And I think the feeling that the Derzhavnost is threatened, and one of the places it is threatened from is from China. And you tend to feel this more in the Far East than you would in the European part of Russia. But again, it raises some, not for this podcast, but some interesting geopolitical questions, because Russia is always trying to create some form of alliance with China against the West. But, you know, as the foreign affairs analyst Fyodor Lukyanov once said to me, the big problem with that alliance is Kto Glavny. That one, right? But that's a whole another issue entirely. What about this question of this latent xenophobia becoming more and more manifest? Do you see that happening, or do you see it staying latent?
Sort of informally monitoring the Russian blogosphere, I would say that it's becoming less latent. And in fact, possibly thanks to Putin's own sort of brief opening up when in the immediate aftermath of the winter protest. So this is Medvedev, I suppose, opening up. But Putin's in his campaign, in his programmatic, you know, op-eds, he also opens the door to these internet petitions that Navalny's now been using. And obviously, after the riot, he released the visa proposal.
The visa regime, yeah.
Right, and actually just the other day, Sputnik y Pogrom, this nationalist website, they didn't specify that they wanted it to be one of these federal petitions, but they did float the idea of taxing all incoming immigrants from Central Asia and the Caucasus to cover potential costs should they need to
be deported.
Should they need to be deported, or should they need medical aid? Because there was this incident 2 days ago in Vladivostok where an illegal immigrant woman came to a maternity ward in labor, and they turned her away because she had neither medical insurance nor the money to pay the fee, which is about $775, apparently. She walked out into the street, collapsed, and she was in labor for about an hour before paramedics and police came to her aid and then basically forced their way into the maternity ward where she was able to give birth. But so that was what Sputnik y Pogrom was responding to. Their response to that was, well, let's start taxing immigrants. So when they do this sort of thing, when they have their babies in our hospitals, we don't have to pay for it, right? Because their criticism is, oh, well, here we go, more immigrants freeloading off of our medical system.
So the civic activism that we had lauded in things like the forest fires is also taking a form that has more of a nationalistic character as well. And this is one of the ways that it could become manifest, but it doesn't necessarily have to manifest itself in a violent way. Yeah.
Right. So this is what I suppose. I mean, the responsible nationalist would claim is that we're not rioting in the streets. We're not having pogroms, but we are going through the legal processes and so on. So Navalny has a petition for visa regimes, and Prosvirnin, the guy who runs Sputnik y Pogrom, is apparently now promoting this idea of a tax. I don't know how serious he's going to get with it, but it does seem like something that could have potential mass appeal. This is what's in store if nationalists are if they're able to sort of win more room in the democratic process.
I'd like to also point out something interesting. The director of our Belarusian service informed me that in Minsk, signs have been spotted at bus stops recruiting migrant workers of Slavic appearance. Which is interesting. I asked him if he sees more of that. This might be an indication there's an attempt to change the profile of the migrant worker community. I don't think they're going to get enough just from Belarus to fulfill all the needs, because migrant workers are in fact needed in Russia. One of the things I wanted to move to was the generational aspect of all of this, because we've talked a lot on this podcast about this new post-Soviet generation, the first generation to grow up and now is coming of age with no Soviet experience whatsoever. And on this podcast and on my blog, I've been guilty of painting this in a very positive light, that this generation is more cosmopolitan, is more worldly, is more progressive in its politics, is more democratic. But one other thing is it also seems to be more nationalistic, more xenophobic. It's the first generation that didn't grow up and take as a given that they did indeed share a country with Tajiks and Uzbeks and Armenians and Azeris, etc. Mark, what do you make of this generational aspect? I mean, I haven't seen hard data on this. I was looking for some of the internals on the Levada poll to see if there's any breakdowns. And I haven't come across them yet. But what do you think intuitively?
Yeah, I agree with you that we need to be cautious. I mean, first of all, let's just question about whether this is a truly post-Soviet generation. Okay, their own personal life experiences are since 1991. But nonetheless, I mean, there is going to be a whole variety of stuff which is actually, you know, basically in their bones, ranging from the Soviet architecture of the sort of the great crumbling apartment blocks, through to just the values that they have imbibed. And it's always this sort of game of Chinese whispers that each generation seeks to transmit certain values on and never really does it properly. It's always going to shift and mutate and morph as it moves along. And I think one of the sort of the buttresses of Soviet internationalism, after all, was precisely that everyone had their home state. Even if it was within this Soviet Federation of fraternal yada yada yadas, nonetheless, there was that sense of, you know, the Tajiks who are here in Moscow, yes, we may not like them or whatever, but they are Tajiks from within our country, and there is a Tajikistan, there is a country there, and, you know, theoretically, I could go there. Yeah. But, I mean, you know, again, that sense of a unit. I mean, this is one of the interesting things about the people from the North Caucasus, and, you know, they are, who are not really being regarded as Russians. I mean, I think we've seen a fragmentation of that notion of a multi-ethnic, multi-state federation, even if the Russian Federation is called that. And therefore, I think this generation, yes, they're more progressive, they're more democratic, they dress better and they have cell phones. All of that is perfectly true, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they have to be nicer people. I mean, the thing is, Soviets were not nasty people. Post-Soviets are not nicer people. They're just different people with different idioms and a whole different sense of how the world ought to operate and how they can operate within it. Mm. So, you know, we would like to feel that there is a natural evolution towards not just political but also ethnic and communal pluralism. Well, there is no real evidence of that. There have been all kinds of cases in which one can point to a slow accretional process of, you know, in which kind of communities get more used to each other and more happy living with each other. But that takes generations, not just a quick flip of the switch and mm-hmm. suddenly everyone's got an iPhone. So, I mean, I don't think it's at all surprising. In some ways, I think it's faintly encouraging that there aren't, I mean, however ghastly they may be, there aren't more Biryulyevas and such like. Exactly the very fact that people are talking about laws and rules and taxes and all kind of constitutional and democratic ways of achieving what we might think of as rather disgraceful ends, that is progress. It's not progress as quick as we might like, but it is progress. Mm.
What do you think, Sean? Can the Soviet Union teach contemporary Russia a little something about tolerance? Or can the Soviet experience teach contemporary Russia a little something about tolerance, maybe?
I mean, however one kind of evaluates the success or failure of the Soviet nationality policy, at least on a discursive level, it had a language of kind of inclusion. Mm-hmm. And today's Russia, we don't – I mean, there's a very stark rejection of multiculturalism, both at a governmental level to some extent and certainly at a popular level. But I think it's one of the things that's significant that in terms of this younger generation, I mean, they have grown up in a situation where Russia is not a multi-ethnic federation within Russia, but all of these other former Soviet states that were part of the Soviet Union are now separate countries, and you have a lot of a demographic shift in terms of Russians, say, for example, who are in Kazakhstan, mm-hmm. or in this case in Chechnya, moving back to Russia proper. So the diasporas that were in these former Soviet states are now moving back to Russia, and sometimes under great hardship. But nonetheless, there's a kind of consolidation of peoples based on ethnicity. You know, one can speak of a consolidation of peoples as a result of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And the fact that now this is because of immigration and internal migration from the North Caucasus and other of the borderlands of Russia, particularly along Central Asia, because of migration and immigration, you do get within a capitalist economy, right, mm-hmm. where you have more competition. However well or the labor market is in Russia, you do have more competition. Certainly much more than in the Soviet period, right? So you have more tensions within society over those questions. You have more tensions over one's ability to get by in daily life. So that butts people up against various ethnic identifications. But as far as the generational aspect of this, yeah, Russian youth are far more cosmopolitan, but their cosmopolitanism is looking westward to Europe. They're not necessarily a cosmopolitan towards, you know, non-white right. Europeans, right? And this, I think, follows a similar trend, again, kind of in a regional way, in Western Europe to some extent, particularly amongst lower classes, a more animosity towards people of different ethnic or racial background. So yeah, definitely we should exercise a lot of caution in dealing with, you know, is the new generation more democratic and more brighter? But I think, again, to emphasize, it's interesting that two things about these expressions today on the political level and some of the things that Kevin mentioned. First, this is an organization of nationalism that looks to create kind of like what I've seen recently in articles comparing Navalny to Le Pen in the sense of creating a nationalistic democratic party. And that democratic party is against the Putin system. So it's seen as an opposition. I think this is really significant that it's starting to organize, or at least there's efforts to organize it as a legal entity rather than, you know, bands of skinhead gangs roaming the streets and beating people up.
Well, yeah, and this is something Navalny says repeatedly, is that you have to bring nationalism into the mainstream, otherwise it'll be controlled by the retrograde elements. We'll see how that plays out. Something else I would say about this generation, not just the post-Soviet aspect, but this might be just as important, is it's the first generation to grow up in real relative prosperity. And now that prosperity is beginning to be severely threatened because the rise of this generation did coincide with the oil boom of the Putin years. And you had wealth spreading like it never has before in Russia. And now, since 2008, and God, I'm looking at the growth figures now, this appears to be very much under threat, and there's a lot of anxiety, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that in the second half. Kevin, you're reading the blogs all the time, and these young people of all political stripes are out there posting their views online. What do you see in this generation? Can you characterize it in any way that distinguishes it?
Well, so to respond to first one point that you just made in response to Sean, the idea that this current generation that's now coming of age matured in prosperity might not be entirely correct. Because so someone like Navalny, for instance, is 37. So yes, he spent the last decade or so in relative prosperity under Putin, but his truly formative years were in the 90s, mm-hmm. I'd say, which were a far more turbulent period, and they were less economically prosperous. So if you look at work by somebody like Ronald Engelhardt, he would say that the formative years are what matter for
right.
shaping.
No, I was thinking more of the people in their 20s, who are Navalny's followers, rather than people like Navalny who are in their late 30s.
It's an interesting point. But I think the generational question is linked to questions about whether such a thing as liberal nationalism is even possible. So the Ruski March and Navalny's brand of new nationalism, these events, this ideology, they march under the banner of what's called liberal nationalism. And one of the ideas of this philosophy is that this sort of nationalism is new. It's informed by some kind of Western-leaning social perspective. So what does that mean? How does this label stand up if we try to evaluate it in terms of how well does it reflect Western liberal values? So I would look at what the organizers of the Russian March approved. They approved the 14 points that supposedly represent the purpose of the event. So first they adapted and endorsed the 14-word racist slogan coined by the American white supremacist David Lane. This is the Russian adaptation. We must protect our Russian land for our future and the future of, and for our Russian children's future. So this is adapted from David Lane, who was arrested and killed in prison and so on. He's a white supremacist terrorist. They've adapted that slogan. So they then offer 14 component slogans to symbolize what the march is supposed to represent. And many of these slogans are really strange and actually indistinguishable from what the communists, the Soviet communists, not the contemporary Russian communists, what they preached. So this includes things like nationalizing entirely the natural resources extraction industry, which is a kind of odd claim given that it's pretty well nationalized already, introducing an ethnic quota system, expanding pronatalist policies, and then, of course, they have these new restrictions on human migration. And so the oddness of these slogans all put together in a supposedly nationalist, a supposedly liberal nationalist platform is really odd, I think. It's very strange. Actually, the Chechen writer German Sadulayev published a very funny op-ed in Svobodnaya Pressa that dissected the sort of illiberality of these 14 points. So I do think that if we're looking at this as representative of a new generation, I think it's very curious that the organizers of the march that supposedly is the sort of best manifestation of this new trend, when they actually sit down and try to write out a platform, what we get is this sort of ideological gibberish, really.
Well, but let's step back a bit from that, and I agree that that ideological gibberish, that's a good way to characterize it, and look at the concept of liberal nationalism itself. Is liberal nationalism possible, is it a contradiction in terms? Mark, what do you think?
Well, I think it's entirely possible. I mean, most liberal states are nationalist to greater or lesser extents. Most liberal electorates are fairly nationalist. But I think the interesting thing is that the extent to which precisely this is increasingly being constructed as an anti-government force. It is harnessing nationalism to a particular purpose. Now, you know, obviously all slogans, all political platforms to an extent are ideological gibberish, to use Kevin's expression. I mean, that's the whole point is it's to grab the things that you think are going to grab the electorate. But I mean, let me just sort of pick up on that point about nationalizing resources. Now, we can, from our Olympian heights, decide that that's a fairly sort of silly point of view because, you know, take, you know, Gazprom or whatever is largely in state hands and so forth. But the point is, what it does is it speaks to this sense that Putin is presiding over a plundering of Russian resources for private gain and for a small, narrow circle of private gain. The purpose, really, of mobilizing this nationalism is actually to attack Putin on the flank that once upon a time seemed to be his strong point, but now is increasingly looking like a vulnerability. It's actually to make Putin look soft on protecting Russians. Now, the trouble is that, you know, I can see how that makes good sense in a short-term political tactician's way. Because in a way, what you want to do is precisely sort of find some, you know, broad policy platforms, political platforms, which are going to appeal to a large proportion of Russians. Navalny's already sort of had some success with doing that with anti-corruption, that again is one of these issues that can sort of cross a whole variety of different sort of boundaries, class, location, and so forth. Well, nationalism, likewise, is one of these sort of potentially cohering forces. And it is one precisely in which, yes, Putin can dabble with, but he can't come out in a sort of full-throated support of ethnic Russians and Russia for the Russians and so forth without severely damaging his credibility internationally, his credibility with the elite and so forth. So, you know, this is an area in which Putin is limited. The problem is that it's precisely, well, what are the long-term implications of this tactic? That it's all very well thinking of it as a handy way in which you can hopefully bring about regime change, which allows you to do all kinds of other wonderful, lovely liberal things. Just all we need to do is change the government and we can do nice liberal things. Well, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of Leninists who are very much of the same opinion. I think my concern is that while it is entirely possible to have liberal nationalism, the danger is, in fact, in practice, you end up, by playing to the nationalism, you end up actually sacrificing your capacity to really be particularly liberal. And just a final point, I mean, and to some extent, I think this is some of these things that Levada poll, the trends reflect. It's actually about how people articulate their feelings. I'm sure there are some people who 5 years ago thought they had absolutely no problem with non-Russians being in their streets and working on their building sites and so forth, and have now actively changed their mind. However, at the same time, I think there are a lot of people who might say had certain bedrock nationalist assumptions, but that they weren't really thinking about them, as it were. They hadn't been activated. It's now, as this becomes much more of an idiom of public discussion, that these values and these views become much more activated. And I think that's something that the poll change also reflects.
Mm. And we're going to take a little bit of a closer look at the poll in a few moments. And in a few moments, we will continue our discussion of Russia's new nationalism and hear from the director of the Levada Center himself, who recently spoke to RFARL's Russian service. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFARL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. And joining us from Middletown, Connecticut, my home state, is Kevin Rothrock, project editor for RuNet Echo at Global Voices, author of the blog A Good Treaty, and an indispensable observer of the Russian blogosphere. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Today we have a new phase of rising nationalism, xenophobia, and isolationism. This is connected to a sense of growing uncertainty and to the ongoing crisis, which is multifaceted. There is the inertia of the economic crisis of 2008 to 2010, and the authorities' crisis of legitimacy. As a result of these general feelings of insecurity, uncertainty about the future, and vulnerability, people are trying to protect themselves from potential threats.
That was Lev Gudkov, director of the Levada Center, speaking this week to Andrei Shadi of RFRL's Russian service. So we have a combination of economic insecurity, anger about corruption, a vacuum caused by what Gudkov calls the regime's crisis of legitimacy. Do these things all necessarily add up to nationalism and xenophobia? I mean, couldn't they just as easily spur a Russian version of the progressive movement? Or, Sean, what do you think? Am I just hopelessly optimistic again?
Well, you're always kind of hopelessly optimistic. But I think the real problem is that there isn't a political outlet for these feelings and these political positions and this kind of xenophobia in Russian society. I mean, the political parties that exist now don't serve as a way to kind of bring in these feeling sentiments and express them politically. So, you know, Zhirinovsky's party, which would be the natural place for a lot of these to go, people aren't, you know, voting for Zhirinovsky. The Communist Party isn't fulfilling that role, and neither is United Russia. So there seems to be an effort to perhaps create a political party around this idea of liberal nationalism. Or I don't know if there's an idea to create a political party, but there seems to be an effort to develop a political movement of some sort that could capture and exploit this sentiment. And I think this is the essence of – if there's a long-term plan of Navalny, I could see this being it. And like I said earlier, I think the references I've seen in the Russian press in the last couple of days to Le Pen is an interesting thing to think about.
Mm-hmm. Mark, what do you think? Do these factors necessarily have to add up to nationalism and xenophobia, or could they be channeled into something else?
Unfortunately, progressive movements really are products of relative plenty and security, coupled with an immediate challenge to people's understandings of the world or whatever. I wish I could be more optimistic, but I think that, you know, we are heading towards a nationalist era in Russia, if nothing else because Russia has never yet had a chance to properly work out its whole state-building process. The Tsarist state was a multi-ethnic empire, though clearly it was run by Russians. But even then, there were all kinds of roles for, you know, Nicholas I's Baltic German aristocrats, whom he trusted, frankly, more than the Russians and so forth. Then you had the sort of the whole Soviet multi-ethnic experiment. And even then, from the beginning, one could see that the more progressive views that were held by many of the old Bolsheviks were not ones that were shared by most of their followers, let alone necessarily Russians as a whole. And the Russian Federation was basically created by the stroke of a pen, simply because of the way that the Soviet Union was collapsed. So there has never actually been, in certainly, well, or not never, but, you know, Russia has not yet gone through, in the period of modernity, actually a sense of creating this kind of state that it wants to be. And I think there is a sense of that. And unfortunately, people can be progressive in all kinds of ways, and yet still feel this sense that we have not yet built our own country. And well, I think that has to be played out first.
Well, I think something that needs to be pointed out and said repeatedly is that the population of the Russian Federation, if I'm not mistaken, is approximately 85% ethnic Russian. Now, if you even look at a country like Germany, which has kind of a blood and soil notion of nationhood, It is a nation with a state. I'm not sure if the figure of non-Germans living in Germany is any lower than that. So despite the fact that, and as Sean, as you very succinctly put a couple of weeks ago on the podcast and in your piece on the nation, that Russians feel themselves to be a nation without a state, in fact, it is. The Russian Federation is 85% Russian. Kevin, what are your thoughts on all this?
I think it's ironic to think about progressivism because Putin has at various times compared Russia's oligarchs to American business tycoons. So if that comparison holds up, muckrakers like Navalny and company would seem to be appearing sort of right on schedule. And I'm not sure that point's made very often. The other point that isn't made very often, and I'm not sure to what degree this is not a liberal statement to make, but I think it's awfully strange that Russia has no visa regime with any of these nations in Central Asia or the Caucasus. It's almost as though the Kremlin is sort of trolling the nationalists. I mean, why not even institute a visa regime with just very high limits on who can come? The fact that there is literally no visa regime really opens the door to campaigns like Navalny's, where whatever numbers you set are irrelevant. You can make this larger argument that, hey, they're letting in anybody. There's no visa regime of any kind. The government is not looking out for the responsible maintenance of the population and our demography and so on. So I do think it's odd that there is no visa regime whatsoever, and I'm not sure if that's just sort of poor politics on the part of the Kremlin, or if I'm missing some sort of.
I think it's a CIS thing, if I'm not mistaken.
It is.
I wanted to play another clip from Andrei Shadi's excellent interview with Lev Gudkov and get everybody's reaction to that. So let's listen to Lev Gudkov again.
There is also a loss of confidence in the authorities, which in a paternalistic society such as Russia always leads to severe frustration, that the authorities are increasingly viewed as corrupt, selfish, caring only about self-preservation, and their own profit and advantage. All of this together creates a strong need for a return to an ethnic hierarchy in order to assure one's own privileged position, to protect it from possible threats from outsiders.
What I found interesting here was the notion that he said at the very first part of the quote, that due to how paternalistic Russian society is, any loss of confidence in the authorities leads to severe frustration. Is this part of the problem, Sean? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, this goes to this idea I have that Russia is a nation without a state, in the sense that Russians don't think the state protects them or gives them privileges as Russians. And the idea that you can have a kind of a nation state, which Russia has never had, this would inevitably lead to say, well, yes, at least, you know, I may not be that well off economically, but at least I'm still Russian, and that gives me certain privileges, and maybe under the law, maybe under the political structure. Now, as you rightly say, that 85% of the Russian Federation is Russian, but there has been this long historical feeling that the Russian people are kind of colonized by their state, that they are kind of colonial, as crazy as it may sound, kind of colonial subjects within a multi-ethnic empire, just like, for example, other non-Russian groups as colonial subjects. So I think in my reading of Gudkov's quote, a lot of this kind of – it speaks to a lot of these beliefs that Russians don't feel represented by their state.
Mm-hmm. Mark, what do you think, the relationship between Russian paternalism and Russian xenophobia and nationalism?
I'm always a bit worried about these sort of notions of, oh, Russians, they had this paternalism, because it tends to just be a different way, a sort of slightly more politically correct way of saying, oh, these funny Russians, they're always going to have their strange little ways. But on the other hand, I mean, I think what I would say is that politics, like nature, abhors a vacuum. Certainly what we have seen in the Putin and pre state building program has been very much one that essentially has sought to re-centralize not just the sinews of politics, but how people think about politics. That whenever anything goes wrong, that's all right because Putin is going to jump out of a plane, parachute down, and fix it. Everything that is fine happens through the central state structure. And given that we do now have a central state structure that isn't working that effectively, that doesn't seem to be as in tune with its people, doesn't have the instruments to be able to fix everything that goes wrong, then that actually does create, you know, you don't have to talk about paternalistic values or whatever. You just simply say that this is a state that requires the constant manual intervention of the Kremlin. And when the Kremlin isn't there, therefore the system doesn't work. So people are going to be looking for alternatives. And given that this is not a system in which people can look for alternatives, as it were, in terms of meaningful political process, they can't say, oh, well, that's all right, you know, because we have a whole slew of other candidates and parties that we can turn to instead, and they can fix it for us, or whatever. People will be looking for alternatives. And if you haven't got, you know, we're back to the sort of the role that nationalism plays. If you haven't got an institutional alternative to turn to, you will look for an emotional, ideological alternative. And therefore, that's the appeal of someone like Navalny or whoever, you know, another figure might well emerge next year. But someone like Navalny, because he seems to be offering opportunities to fix the system from outside the system.
Right. So the way I would put that is in the absence of the institutions, which leads to civic patriotism, which is essentially pride in your institutions, you have the street and you have nationalism. So it's but what we have now is it's either the regime or the street. Kevin, last word to you before we wrap up, because we're about to get kicked out of the studio.
what we've basically been describing here is this idea that Russians lack a sense of political efficacy because the institutions are so closed off and politics is so managed. I'm not sure that dips or absences of political efficacy elsewhere will always lead to nationalism. So if we treat that as sort of the causal mechanism here, I'm not sure that the mechanics work out exactly. The one thing I would also say about the concept of paternalism is that it's sort of a club with which critics or hit over the head just about anybody. The public is too paternalist because they depend on the state. The officials are too paternalist because they meddle in facets of Russians' lives. The liberals are too paternalistic because they fear the unwashed nationalist masses, and then they consent with the Putin regime that the nationalists must be denied access to the democratic process. So I think this gets into really politicized language. I'm not sure how much we gain from sort of weighing who's paternalistic and what the sort of consequences of that are. I would just sort of caution against that.
Okay. Any last words from anybody before they start banging down the doors? Okay, that is all we have time for today, folks. Really, I'd like to remind you, if you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast, my name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. And joining us from Middletown, Connecticut, has been Kevin Rothrock, project editor for Runet at Global Voices, author of the blog A Good Treaty, and an indispensable observer of the Russian blogosphere. Thanks, as always, for the great discussion, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our brilliantly patient and patiently brilliant producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd like to also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfr.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.